Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. And while that is, I think, true every day, it is especially true today, because we are going to be speaking for a full hour with Dr. Sebastian Gorka, a man who has come to great prominence in the wake of, well, several things. The rising tide of jihadism, his expertise in this area, and not least his now best-selling book, Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War. Dr. Gorka is these days the Marine Corps University's Major General Matthew C. Horner Distinguished Chair of Military Theory. He is contributing mightily, as I've mentioned, to the public policy debate about an understanding of the nature of the war we're in. I call it the war for the free world. He's a friend and colleague and a great contributor to the fight. Dr. Gorka, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you, and thank you for giving us so generously of your time. I know how busy you are. It's really appreciated.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be back on the show. Let's do this.
Do it. Let's start with one of the points that you make repeatedly in your book, Defeating Jihad, and perhaps in part because of your admonitions and part, of course, because of the political environment we're in. There is a lot of talk these days being given to who the enemy is in this war, and the difficulty it seems that some, particularly in the senior ranks of the U.S. government, are having at the moment in coming to grips with that. Talk about that, if you would.
Yes, so I think we've seen some very interesting developments the last few days, especially the response to the Orlando attack, which is the most significant terrorist attack on U.S. territory since September the 11th. What we saw with the Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, trying to censor the transcript of what the murderer, Omar Mateen, was saying to the 911 hacker, needs to be understood not as some kind of strange anomaly, but in fact the most egregious example of what we've been experiencing and you've been talking about as well for the last 7.5 years, which is a systematic perversion of the intelligence cycle and the threat assessment that disallows federal law enforcement and the military to talk accurately and honestly about who the enemy is. And I recommend to your listeners just this. As a result, Senator Cruz held a very important hearing on this issue of systematic censorship of who the enemy is and why we're not allowed to call them by the names they call themselves, such as jihadists. This is a politically driven agenda that is endangering the lives of Americans, Frank.
It is indeed. I'm sorry to say we've been following this, as I think you have too, for more than the past 7.5 years. It really was evident in part during the Bush years, as you know, but it's become certainly infinitely worse now under the Obama administration. And thank you for mentioning Senator Cruz's hearing. I want to talk with you at some length about the willful blindness that he exposed there. And also, by the way, yesterday at the Senate Judiciary Committee's full committee hearing with the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson. But before we let the question go, Seb, how would you define the enemy that we are confronting these days?
I like a phrase that I didn't invent, but comes out of the Office of the Director for National Intelligence, the global jihadi movement. I completely reject what the Obama administration uses as the violent extremism youth that really is an attempt to make us, the American public, disconnect the dots, along with other phrases like lone wolf terrorists. The enemy, whether it is Omar Mateen, whether it is the people who executed the attack in Istanbul, Boston bombers, Major Nital Hassan, the Fort Hood shooter, they're all connected, and the connective tissue is the ideology of jihad, the belief that they are doing what they do for the glory of Allah and in the objective of recreating the caliphate. So for me, the enemy is a global movement, and their ideology is jihadism, Frank.
Jihadism, Seb, and this is a point on which, as you know, some of us in the space have had some disagreements. And I'd just like to explore this with you, because this is really, as you've indicated, and I think done a very significant contribution to this fight in the various platforms to which you have access these days, making the point that we do have to get our hands around the ideological underpinnings of this this threat. And I think there's no question about it. There is a global jihadist movement, and that it is animated by this ideology. I wonder whether you would disagree with me, Seb, that, and again, you've made this point in your book, Defeating Jihad, we ought to be guided by what the enemy says about themselves and about their program. And we were together on Armstrong Williams' show the other day, and I made this point there. This ideology, I think, the jihadists would say, is not jihad, but Sharia. That jihad is the technique for ensuring that Sharia, a totalitarian program, is made, supreme the world over. Would you disagree with that?
For a couple of reasons, and it comes to communications with the American voter. There's a factual issue. When you read the magazines of Dabiq, of ISIS, such as Dabiq or Al-Qaeda, the magazine Inspire, they don't spend a lot of time talking about Sharia. They spend a lot of time talking about the infidel and jihad. I like to distinguish I like to separate, and this is just me, the threat of the terrorists from those who use covert and subversive means to inculcate the Sharia doctrine into the American political system, such as CARE and everybody else. And for me, the talk of Sharia doesn't resonate enough with the average American taxpayer. So for me, I think you get people's attention, and that's really so important today when you talk about jihadis and jihadism. But within that, of course, Sharia is paramount, is crucial, because it is the broader worldview, if you will, that facilitates the totalitarian ideology that we're talking about. So it's just a personal preference. I think in terms of political communication, jihadism has the right resonance for me, and then experts like yourself in an expert forum can dissect that and talk about Sharia as well.
That's helpful, Seb, because I want to be clear where there may be disagreements, and this the question of presentation, public presentation, is of course a challenge that we face when we're dealing with something that is truly as incomprehensible for most of us as is this totalitarian repressive program of Sharia, and is this jihadism, and particularly its violent manifestations. But could I just ask you to clarify one point, Seb, and then we'll take a brief pause and jump back into this. But did I understand you to say that you thought that there was some distinction to be made between the violent jihadists on the one hand and the jihadists who are using techniques like, they call it the hijra, migration, or zakat, material support, or civilization jihad, in the words of the Muslim Brotherhood. Is there some distinction to be made there, other than obviously the violent is particularly gruesome?
Well, the only distinction to be made is that it's a tactical one, that they are both of the same strategic objective. So they both wish the same thing, to create theocratic, unconstitutional orders around the world that will be a global caliphate. And I think I like to put a distinction between them. They come from the same place. They come from the Muslim Brotherhood. The ideology they share is the same. Their approach to how to achieve it is different, and I think that requires of us understanding that different tools will be required to deal with them. You can't deal with CARE and then Brotherhood the same way that you deal with ISIS and Al-Qaeda. So for me, it's a terminological difference that derives from how they're going to achieve their objectives and how we're going to defeat them.
We'll drill down on this at greater length in the course of the rest of the program. Our guest is Dr. Sebastian Gorka, the Major General Matthew C. Horner Distinguished Chair of Military Theory at the Marine Corps University, the author of Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War, and also one of the contributors to a terrific book, again, we'll talk about this too, Fighting the Ideological War, Winning Strategies from Communism to Islamism. Much more to come with Dr. Gorka right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. Our guest is Dr. Sebastian Gorka. You see him everywhere. He's like the Scarlet Pimpernel, I think, in the best sense of the word. He is at the moment helping us understand the nature of the enemy we're facing and how to defeat them. It is the subject of his new book, a New York Times bestseller, I'm pleased to say, Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War. He is a professor at the Marine Corps University and a very active contributor to the public policy debate. And Seb, we were talking there about the Brotherhood and it as being sort of a feedstock, if you will, for jihadists of all kinds, employing all of these different techniques. This is an organization that is very poorly understood, it seems, by the U.S. government. I mean, as bad as the problem is generally in terms of understanding the enemy, it seems particularly true of the Brotherhood. Describe its role in this global jihad movement.
This is absolutely something that isn't adequately understood, not just by the general public, but by the United States government, the law enforcement, and the military, mainly because of the censorship we've experienced in the last 7 years. So the Muslim Brotherhood is the granddaddy of all modern. So jihad can be traced back 1,400 years to the establishment of the Muslim faith. We know Muhammad was a military leader. He vanquished and destroyed whole tribes, Jewish tribes, Arab tribes. So jihad has been part of the faith story, if you will, for more than 1,000 years. It's modern reinvention and its development into a global scourge that resulted in 9/11 and all the attacks we see today can be laid at the doorstep of the Ikhwan Muslimin, the Muslim Brotherhood, which was created in the Suez region of Egypt in 1928. And why was it created? It was created in direct response to the dissolution 4 years previously by President Ataturk of the caliphate. So as a result of World War I, the president of the new secular Turkish Republic decreed that after 1,000 years, 1,100 years of existence, there would be a more theocratic empire and the caliph would be retired. In response, we saw fundamentalist jihadi organizations created around the world, but they all derived their ideological foundation from the Muslim Brotherhood.
We're talking with Seb Gorka, and you're making this critically important point about the role that the Brotherhood has played in inspiring and spawning, really, virtually all of the modern jihadist organizations, Seb. And yet we're seeing the United States government, it was, I think, palpable, if not made explicit, in the comments that Secretary Jay Johnson of the Department of Homeland Security made to Senator Cruz just yesterday in the Judiciary Committee hearing, to the effect that the people that he's talking to, the Muslims that he's talking to, are telling him you can't use words like Islam and Sharia and jihad because it will offend us and we won't be able to help you help us. Seb, is it the case today that the United States government has been embracing what are in fact the leading edge of the enemy of the global jihadist movement?
Well, the facts are plain and anybody can Google them. The Council for American Islamic Relations was decreed to be an unindicted co-conspirator in the Holy Land Foundation trial, which was the largest terrorism threat financing trial in U.S. history. Yet despite being listed as such, it continued to provide advice, training, and influence policy within the highest levels of the U.S. government. And not only that, 6 years ago, the White House decreed and sent an unclassified memo to the then Attorney General and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the highest military officer in the United States, to say that all counterterrorism training must be scrubbed, any mention of Islam must be removed, and words jihad should be prohibited. People must understand that that measure, that self-censorship that endangers Americans, was the direct result of a letter written to the White House and signed by organizations such as CARE, which in my opinion really do not represent American Muslims, but have a stranglehold on how the government understands the threat and what can or cannot be said in the United States today.
I can't frankly get my head around why people don't understand what you just said, Seb, that this kind of practice, this willful blindness, is endangering Americans. And yet we heard Jay Johnson say yesterday that he thinks our law enforcement personnel are smart enough to be able to connect the dots, even if they're not allowed to see some of the dots, even if they're not allowed to be cued to the fact that there are dots to connect, let alone the fact that it is a career-threatening offense to connect those dots. Walk us through that, Seb, and the practical implications of what this willful blindness is doing to our law enforcement, our military, our intelligence personnel, and you train all of them.
Yeah, I really suggest your listeners watch the 6-minute video that Senator Cruz posted on Facebook. Jay Johnson drips arrogance in this congressional hearing. And as you said, in the last replies to the senator, he basically says, well, we are censoring, but our guys will probably work it out anyway. So there's an admission there that they're not allowed to say the truth, and that people like Phil Haney did lose their job, were punished when they did try to connect the dots. And it has reached Pythonic levels of absurdity. If I may share an anecdote, I was in out west 2 months ago, and I briefed 300 law enforcement officers, local, state and local. I gave them 8 hours of what I do, which is understanding the mind of jihad and who these people are and the brotherhood and everything else. At the end of the 8 hours, an attractive young girl walks up to me and says, that's really interesting, Dr. Gorka, you're very smart, but clearly you're wrong on most of these issues, because the major threat to all these law enforcement officers is white supremacist militias. And then she gives me her card, and who does she work for? The Department of Homeland Security. So this is the reality. We have the threat that you, your listeners, myself, live in. And there is the Alice in Wonderland fantasy that the administration has created. And if you step outside of the line of their narrative, you will be punished.
As sort of variation on the theme, which goes back to a point you made earlier about the redacted transcripts of the 9/11 calls that this jihadist Mateen made while he was killing people in Orlando. That was, in a way, bizarrely, it was very helpful that the FBI did that, because it made accessible to lots of people what you and I have been warning about for a long time. But I'm told that the organization you rightly described as a Muslim Brotherhood Front, the Council on American Islamic Relations, was involved in not only selecting the people that the FBI could meet with from the mosque that the shooter attended, and attended very faithfully, by the way, but they also sat in on the interviews that the FBI conducted with such people. I mean, from the perspective of a counterterrorism professional, a political warfare expert, what are the implications of that, Seb Gorka?
The implications are that the people who carry the badges, the credentials, and the guns, who have vouchsafed the safety of their fellow Americans, are living in an Orwellian world where the people who have shared interests, those who want to kill Americans and undermine the American constitutional order, have an influence, have a say in how these individuals are investigated. It's if you read it in a Tom Clancy novel, I think you would say this is absurd. But this is the situation we are in. The idea that we cannot talk truth about who the enemy is, and when an enemy does rear his head, that those who sympathize with him are part of the process in which he is screened, it beggars belief.
It does indeed. Seb Gorka, we're going to be talking more about all of that right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The U.S. government is indeed willfully blind about Sharia supremacism and the danger it poses to America. Senator Ted Cruz has established that Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson could qualify for a seeing eye dog. And why? In a Senate hearing yesterday, Secretary Johnson displayed ignorance of and indifference to the damning charges leveled by one of his former employees, whistleblower Philip Haney. Mr. Haney has documented how official Sino-Sharia policies and purges are interfering with investigations and allowing Americans to be killed. Secretary Johnson said his Muslim interlocutors insist that, quote, ISIS has hijacked my religion, unquote, so he's focused on the, quote, need to build bridges to American Muslim communities and not vilify them so they will help us help them, unquote. These are the narratives of the Muslim Brotherhood and proof positive of their successful subversive influence operations inside the Obama administration. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back in a very special edition of Secure Freedom Radio, speaking with Dr. Sebastian Gorka of the Marine Corps University, the author of Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War, these days a bestseller on the New York Times list, as well as number one in Amazon under Islam and other categories. He has contributed mightily, I think, of late in particular, to the public policy debate about what's happened to us, what went down in Orlando, and why. And we're stitching many of these points together in a full-hour conversation with him, which I'm very grateful for. We were talking before the break, Seb, about the degree to which we find ourselves, most especially those, as you say, in the front lines of defense for this country, find themselves censoring what they see, what they say, for sure, and I guess really what they do as well, lest they lose their jobs under a government that finds this unacceptable. And as you've interacted with these local and state and federal law enforcement officers, these intelligence officers, these military personnel, Are you finding that they know what you're telling them, or are you really opening doors to them that had been closed? And when you do, how are they reacting?
Well, most of the people I work with are actual operators. The level of generals, but the fact is I like to work with young officers and agents and peace officers. And for most of them, American soul is defined by common sense. And if you've had four tours in Afghanistan or Iraq, I don't need to tell you who the enemy is. So there's an intuitive understanding of the severity of the threat. But they want the information that they're not allowed to be provided and which has been censored. So they're incredibly thirsty for the details of what it is that is Sharia, for example. Where does the Muslim Brotherhood fit into it? Who are the strategists of jihad? So the average individual that is in these organizations is a patriot, hasn't been given the information, and when their eyes are open to the complexity, the diversity of the enemy threat, they are very, very appreciative. As we go up the chain, as we get to political appointees, of course, there's an inverse proportion there, Frank.
And I guess it's fair to say that general officers are, in a sense, political appointees these days. They've made it up that far in the pecking order of the military, in part because they're good at the political piece of it, as well as, of course, hopefully the military piece. And Seb, knowing what you do about, this doctrine of Sharia, is it fair to say that what we're doing by our government, I should say, denying military officers, denying intelligence personnel, denying Department of Homeland Security and other law enforcement officers this sort of information is tantamount, whether we acknowledge it or not, to sort of conforming to Sharia blasphemy laws, that we give no offense to Muslims? Is that in part what is impelling this, do you think, or at least that's the practical effect of it?
I think that's a way to package it, but I wouldn't go there because it requires a level of sophistication that most people who aren't following this closely have as yet. What I'd like to say is it's really a logical chain of thought that eventually will make us want to sympathize or support the narrative that the perpetrator is the victim. How absurd it gets. What happened after Orlando? After Orlando, 49 Americans are dead. Dozens are in hospital. And the Attorney General of the United States says her priority is to prevent Islamophobic reaction. Hang on. Americans have been killed by a man who says he's doing it in the name of Allah, and the priority of the federal government is to protect Muslims who haven't been endangered at all. This is the upside-down world we live in. And as the hearing this week indicated, it also has a very, very dangerous effect because you are not allowed to talk about the flags or indicators of jihadism. As a result, if you can't say the word jihad and a person calls himself a jihadi, you won't be able to report it, and they may actually go kinetic before we can stop them.
Well, and that's why I think it is important to drill down on this. And, I respect the terrific job you are doing communicating on so many of these points. But I do think to some extent we've got a duty to be sure we're giving people the full truth as well as what we think they can take aboard. And in this regard, why I think it matters so much, Seb, to come to your last point, that they understand that what we're doing by pulling our punches or not telling the truth about the ideology and the nature of the enemy and naming the enemy and, making the obvious point that when you're told this has nothing to do with Islam, that's simply not true. It may not be something that all Muslims embrace, but it's not true that it has nothing to do with Islam. We may describe all of that or dress it up in our heads as political correctness or multiculturalism or diversity sensitivity, but isn't it the case that the enemy regards that differently? They see it as submission. And their response to submission on the part of the infidels is, as you say, to go more kinetic. So we're likely to get worse violence, more jihad rather than less.
Yeah, look, the enemy sees it as that, but the idea that the cabinet of the United States is cognizant in its willful submission to Sharia blasphemy laws, I think that's a stretch. The bottom line is their actions end in the same result, but the idea that that's actually what they're doing, I think it's far more a function of their worldview. If you look at how these people were trained, where they came from, the influence of people such as Saul Alinsky, this is a group of individuals who simply don't like America. I can't go that extra step to say they want us to be in compliance with Sharia law because I think it's simpler than that. These are people who don't believe in America, and their actions will get us to the same place, but I think we have to wait until the evidence is in, until we find the smoking. Loretta Lynch thinks America should be a caliphate. I'm going to hold my fire until that moment.
Well, that's a fair point. And I don't really mean to be speaking to motivation. I'm interested in the practical effect of what they're doing. And I think you're right. It is the same thing. And, I'm thinking of in part as an example to speak to specifics, Seb, Hillary Clinton's role in the Istanbul process and talking about shaming and peer pressure. Would you just walk us through that as an example of getting us to that endpoint, whatever her motivations may have been?
Yeah, so this is a very interesting story, and this is probably requires another hour to discuss. There's the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or the Organization of the Islamic Conference, as it used to be called. And they have been explicitly, in their own planning memoranda, talking about how international organizations, especially the United Nations, have to incorporate laws and regulations that mean the defamation of religion becomes illegal. But of course, not the defamation of all religions, just the defamation of Islam. And Hillary Clinton, with what motivation I dread to think, has been facilitating when she was Secretary of State this process by committing America to various commissions and various initiatives that make the criticism of Islam an offense. In such a way that, again, brings us to a point where it doesn't matter what the motivation is, but at the end of the day, it's the same thing. You can criticize Christians or Hindus as much as you like, but should you dare say something negative or critical about one specific religion, you will be punished. And at the end of the day, that helps the bad guys, frankly.
It does. And I'm afraid not just helps them, but emboldens them, which is really the key point. And you know, a case in point, of course, arguably being what Hillary Clinton did so much to promote, namely this idea that the video was responsible for the Benghazi attack, and the one guy who goes to jail over it is the guy who makes the video. It is, as you say, sort of a world turned upside down kind of environment. Seb, we have to pause for a moment. When we come back, I want to talk a bit more about the ideology, but also about the infrastructure that is being built here and elsewhere in the West for jihad and the implications of our turning a blind eye to that as well. That and much more with Dr. Sebastian Gorka, the author of Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back for block four of our hour-long conversation with Dr. Sebastian Gorka. He is, as I've mentioned several times, the author of a best-selling book, Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War, a professor at the Marine Corps University, an instructor of military and intelligence and law enforcement personnel across the country, thank God. He is an active contributor to the public policy debate. We're always delighted to have him here. Seb, one of the books that you've also contributed to with your wife, Catherine Gorka, is Fighting the Ideological War, Winning Strategies from Communism to Islamism. And I want to get back in the last block to what do we do about all this, but just if you would, tease out the similarities between the ideology of communism and the role that it played in the global communist movement, if you will, and that we're seeing, I think best called the Sharia, but whatever it's called, that is animating the global jihadist movement today.
Yes, so here there's a fascinating parallel, and this is the foundation of my book, Defeating Jihad, because I use our Cold War experience to inform how we should defeat the jihadists today. And we just look at amazing parallels. So both communism and Islamism or jihadism or whatever we wish to call it are totalitarian ideologies. They are predicated on an absolutist stance, and they must be victorious over the whole earth. It is a them or us policy. It is exploiting constantly conspiratorial means, and it brooks no compromise. It's very important for our listeners to appreciate these are not individuals who can be negotiated with, and whether it's Khrushchev or whether it's Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, either they will crush us or we will crush them. Those are the only two scenarios. And yes, you know, one of them is transcendentally informed in that it has a religious narrative, but I love quote the famous Hungarian former communist and then a warrior for freedom, Arthur Koestler, who penned the phrase communism, the godless religion. And that's exactly what we're talking about here. In its absolutist attitude, both of these ideologies are an existential threat to the United States, and therefore the similarities are far closer than the differences.
Come up with a sort of variation on the theme. If communism was a godless religion, we are dealing with a sort of communism with a god in the Islamic traditions of Sharia. And Seb, turning to another point, and in a way, it's doubling back to some of the conversation we've had already about the Muslim Brotherhood and these Islamic supremacists who are not currently engaged, or not believed to be at least engaged in the violent jihad. Talk a little, if you would, about the role beyond the influence operations. And those are troubling enough, especially given the success they've had over 50 years in the United States government. But specifically, I'm thinking about the role that the Brotherhood and its friends have played in building out a kind of infrastructure across America, as well as elsewhere in the West, and the tie-ins between that infrastructure and the violent jihads.
Yes, so you've done legendary work in uncovering the network that was first unveiled in the Holy Land Foundation trial, and there the appendix which lists the unindicted co-conspirators, I think, runs to, 30-plus organizations. So there's front organizations for the Brotherhood that have been established here decades ago. But this isn't just a problem for America, it's a global one. The Brotherhood is present everywhere. It has its front organizations in the Middle East, where it was founded, Egypt, Jordan, where have you. It has political parties that are the front political activists, if you will. And then it has its connections to the terrorists. And here, you don't have to be conspiratorial or, you know, put your tinfoil hat on. Just look at the unclassified biographical data of every leading jihadist of the last 20 years, whether it's Osama bin Laden, whether it's the head of al-Qaeda today, Ayman al-Zawahiri. Pick any jihadi terrorist of the kinetic variety, and what will you find? The beginnings of their career began as a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. As Tom Joslin, the wonderful author at the Long War Journal, has testified before Congress, the Muslim Brotherhood is the gateway drug to jihad. And he's absolutely right, Frank.
What I'm interested in beyond that, and I think that's certainly true, is, and again, let's emphasize, this is not true of all Muslims, nor is it true of all mosques in this country. But In your professional judgment, said Gorka, is it likely to be the case that mosques founded by one of the organizations you mentioned that were identified in that explanatory memorandum introduced into evidence in the Holy Land Foundation trial, the North American Islamic Trust, may well be playing a role akin to the ones that the French and the Belgian governments have recently tumbled to as they've gone in and raided mosques in those countries, namely that they are not simply houses of worship, but they're training grounds, they are recruitment facilities, they may even be used to arm jihadists, arsenals in their basement, for example. Is that possible here as well, do you think? And should that be of concern to law enforcement and, well, for that matter, the rest of us?
Well, nothing's out of the question. If you talk to our veterans who came back from Iraq, we know that the mosques were used as arms depots. You know, they knew that they were safe, and as a result, they used them as epicenters for terrorist activity. We've seen in the last 15 years, mosques play a crucial part in the recruitment and the further indoctrination of jihadis. If you look at the Finsbury Park Mosque with regards to the Richard Reid, the shoe bomber, all the way down to Anwar al-Awlaki and to the Boston bombers. Of course, you know, the majority of Muslims, as far as I'm concerned, in America are here because they believe in the Constitution, and we have them in the armed forces, I've been in the FBI. But the fact is, there is a huge issue, especially with those imams who are trained in the Wahhabi or Salafist tradition. If you look at an imam's background, if they were trained in Cairo or they were trained in Pakistan, there's a huge difference between them. If they were trained by the Wahhabists of Saudi Arabia, as opposed to a more liberal version in Cairo, then that should make eyebrows be raised, because the imam is the filter of the Quran. And if he has a Wahhabist interpretation, we may have a significant problem.
Some would call it a Wahhabist interpretation. Some would say it's simply the authoritative rendering of the faith according to Sharia. But whatever terminology you wish to use, it is widespread for sure. And most especially, it is being promoted aggressively by the Muslim Brotherhood, which has, as you said earlier, said Gorka, exactly the same objectives, imposing Sharia worldwide and creating the caliphate that is shared by these various other violent groups, including, by the way, it should be said, those of the Shiite tradition, too. We haven't talked really about Iran here, but is there a dime's worth of difference, really, between the Islamic supremacism of the Sunni community and that of the Shiites, led by Iran?
There are differences in terms of detail, especially their apocalyptic visions are not the same. But you know, to quote Bibi Netanyahu when he addressed Congress, I mean, he absolutely nailed it when he said, look, to understand the catastrophe that is the Middle East today, all you have to know is that it is a game of thrones for the crown of the caliphate. And he's absolutely right. We have the Sunni version of the religion, the extreme the Sunnis, which Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and we have the violent theocratic Shiites, the mullahs of Iran, and both wish to have their caliphate extend across the earth. So there's not no significant difference in terms of what it means to us in terms of a threat, because both of them wish to see us dead or enslaved.
Yeah. And Seb Gorka, we have one last block with you, I'm very pleased to say, coming up. We'll talk about the final jihad that seems to be impelling some of the worst of these jihadists at the moment, and what we're going to need to do to defeat it, to ensure that this is the winnable war. That and more with Dr. Sebastian Gorka, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. In this most important conversation with Dr. Sebastian Gorka about the nature of the enemy we're facing, the challenge that it poses, truly the existential challenge that it poses, of a kind arguably not seen since the darkest days of the Cold War, when communism without a god was at our throats. We now have communism with a god and that same role. Seb, you were talking a bit about Dabiq and Inspire magazine and the various sophisticated efforts being made by some of the most prominent, notably the Islamic State, of these Islamic jihadists. I wondered if you would just talk about the message that they are communicating to their followers or potential recruits about this being the final jihad and the implications of it.
Yes, this is the most important thing about ISIS, and this is why ISIS is not a JV team, but the most dangerous jihadi organization I've ever seen. ISIS follows the jihadi ideology, but it's added its own twist. Because it's captured Syria and Iraq, or territory in both of those countries, it has a different message on social media when it's recruiting. That territory in Arabic is called Al-Sham. Al-Sham is the Megiddo for Islam. It is the site of the last war before judgment. As a result, ISIS has a very seductive message. They are saying to the young Muslims around the world, to that Pakistani immigrant in San Bernardino, to that man of Afghan descent in Florida, look where we are. We have captured what you know is the land of final jihad before Judgment Day. If you ever wanted to be a jihadi, you better come and fight jihad now or kill the infidel in your homeland, because there will be no more jihads. We have begun the last war with the infidel. And that's how they've managed to recruit 86,000 jihadis in just a matter of a couple of years.
Seb, so given all that you've said about the complexion of the enemy, the final jihadist impulse behind what they're doing at the moment, the combination of the violent jihad and the civilization jihad of the Muslim Brotherhood, the infrastructure and all the rest, what is it you commend to us as the way to win this war and to defeat jihad, the subject of your new book?
Well, this is the laughter of defeating jihad. So, number one, we have to get political correctness out of the threat assessment. Number two, we have to assist our Sunni allies, who really are on the front line of this war, to destroy ISIS and similar groups. That's, President Sisi of Egypt, King Abdullah of Jordan. They have to be the face of this war with our assistance, but, after we rebuilt all the relationships that President Obama has destroyed in the last 7 years. And then lastly, we have to, with our Muslim allies, destroy the ideology. We have to delegitimize the brand of global jihad, just as President Reagan did with communism during the end of the Cold War. And beyond that, I really would like all of your listeners to appreciate they are on the front line of this war. After San Bernardino, after Orlando, after Boston, we must be cognizant of the fact that it isn't just people who wear the cloth of the Republic or carry a badge or a gun who are on the front line. It is everybody. And as a result, you have a responsibility to educate yourself and educate the ones around you to the severity of the threat and how this is truly an existential danger that we must all come together to defeat.
Mm. There's so much there. And let's just unpack a bit further in the remaining time we have, Seb Gorka. One, I guess I would just ask you, clearly there is a problem, isn't there, with some of our Sunni allies who are themselves imbued with this ideology and enable it in their own ways, including, I think it's fair to say, to some extent at least, some of their businessmen, some of their royals, perhaps, aiding the Islamic State, if only because they see it as kind of a bulwark against the Shiites who are on the march out of Iran.
Yeah, this is a significant problem. It's actually part of it's a chapter in my book, and Saudi Arabia and Qatar are very much part of the problem. Saudi Arabia, after the siege of Mecca in 1979, signed a devil's pact with the jihadists that assisted them in the export of their ideology around the world. And Qatar, who is meant to be a partner of the United States, is known to be a assisting the ISIS forces. And until recently, Turkey, a NATO nation, was allowing free passage of ISIS fighters across its territory into Syria simply because it saw them as fellow co-religionists and individuals who would attack the Kurds. So yes, this is, you know, there are Sunnis and there are Sunnis, and there are those who have stood steadfastly by us in the past, the Egyptians, the Jordanians, and the Emiratis, and there are those who have been more often a part of the problem as opposed to the solution. So we must be able to discriminate and rely upon those who are reliable, Frank.
Seb, very quickly, you mentioned Turkey helping the Islamic State. They say that the Islamic State has now engaged in this murderous attack against Turks in Istanbul at the airport. Is that just a fight over, Game of Thrones, the fight over who will wear the crown of the caliphate?
It's a little bit more complicated in this case, because unfortunately Erdogan is his own kind of Muslim brother. He's his own kind of fundamentalist. He's not organically connected, but he shares the same kind of atavistic 7th century vision of a great Islam that is fundamental. And as a result, he has been sympathetic to the cause of jihadists until, of course, I think recent events. And now he's having to reassess the cost of what he has done, because it has been under his leadership of Turkey that the incredible important example of Atatürk and a secular Islamic state has been undermined and basically dismantled. So Turkey could have been a key to the answer. It has gone rogue, and hopefully recent events will lead them to reassess their position when it comes to jihadism and to Sharia.
Well, hope is not a strategy, as you say, but it certainly is something that we have to be clear-eyed about. Seb Gorka, let me just close by asking you, and we only have about 2 minutes left. You talked about George Kennan and the role that he played early in the Cold War, not so good later on, but early on in helping think about a strategy for defeating communism. I'm very proud of what President Reagan did, and I had a small role in helping him with National Security Decision Directive 75. Are we at the point where we have an effective strategy in the wings, at least, if not now being used, to counter, to help all of us who take very much to heart your point that we are in the front lines? We have to win this war against the jihad, or we will be destroyed by it.
Well, from my experience, I haven't seen that strategy make itself apparent inside the U.S. government. We are astrategic, and we didn't deny the nature of the threat, and that's why I wrote Defeat Jihad, because I really used George Kennan's long telegram and NSC 68 as my template. We have to have an analysis of who the enemy is, a truthful one, what their strategy is, what they wish to achieve. And then we have to have a plan, 68 or 75. We have to have that strategic plan on how to defeat them. And if we have a clear-eyed analysis and a pragmatic response, we could defeat this threat relatively rapidly, but only if we start by jettisoning political correctness from our threat assessment. So the Cold War, for me, is the template, and if we have leadership, we should be able to win this war, Frank.
Seb Gorka, it is the case. I think we need to bring some of those successful Cold War strategies back, and to bring all instruments of national power to bear. Your exhortations in that regard, and on so many others, Seb, in your writings and in your public appearances, your continuous loop at Fox, among other places, and not least, of course, in your new book, Defeating Jihad, the Winnable War. You're rendering a real public service. We appreciate it so much. Thanks for your time today. As you said, we could usefully spend another hour on all of this, and I hope we'll get a chance to do so soon. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. Keep up the great work. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.